I feel like you're drowning in jargon when you look at a scientific paper. Like, you need a quick way to get the main ideas without getting totally lost. Well, today, we're taking a deep dive into an article that definitely looks intimidating at first glance. It's called Gradient Type Estimates for the Dynamic of the 3.22 Model. Sounds like I'm getting super quick. But our mission here is to, you know, pull out the really important bits of knowledge from this research. We want to show you how mathematicians tackle these really, really rough problems.
Exactly. And this deep dive is really about getting to grips with this specific model, the dynamic Varfi 4210 model.
Yeah.
You can think of it as a kind of foundational example, a toy example, they often call it. But it's a toy example in... Basically, yeah, using randomness to understand quantum systems. And this specific model, the Varfi 4202 one, it describes something fundamental, the natural reversible way a particular mathematical object, the Varfi 4202 measure, sort of evolves and settles down over time.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit more. A toy example in quantum field theory.
Yeah.
Still sounds pretty heavy. What's this Varfi 4202 model actually representing? And, I mean, why dedicate a whole paper just to its dynamics?
Well, it's important because it's a fundamental building block for understanding how these quantum fields behave. Like I said, it describes the natural reversible dynamics of this thing called the Varfi 4202 measure. And this isn't new exactly. The measure itself, the ideas go way back to Nelson's work in quantum field theory.
Okay.
But then later on, Parisi and Wu had this really ingenious idea. Mm. They proposed using these dynamics, the way the system changes, to actually construct the measure.
Yeah.
And also to sample from it using things like MCMC methods, you know, computational simulations to explore these complex mathematical spaces.
MCMC, like Monte Carlo methods.
Exactly, Monte Carlo Markov chain methods. But for a long time, improving the connection, rigorously linking these very singular dynamics.
Singular meaning.
Meaning very rough, very irregular, not smooth at all. Linking those singular dynamics to the measure itself was a huge challenge. It's really only with relatively recent breakthroughs like regularity structures and parallel-controlled calculus that mathematicians could finally nail down that connection rigorously.
Regularity structures and parallel-controlled calculus.
Okay, those sound like serious mathematical firepower. What do they let mathematicians do that they couldn't before?
Yeah, they're kind of like new mathematical superpowers, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine trying to analyze something...
Fascinating. So looking at the core equation in the paper, equation 1.1, I see two things that jump out. This space-time white noise, X, and this plus 3 Euler term, an infinite counter term. How on earth do you work with infinity in an equation? What makes this equation singular?
That's hitting the nail on the head. It's the roughness of that space-time white noise, the X, that makes the whole thing singular. Think of white noise as pure static, incredibly jagged and unpredictable at every single point in space and time. It's not smooth at all.
Okay, like trying to graph pure static.
Exactly. And that infinite counter term, well, that's related to something called renormalization, a concept borrowed from physics. You often get infinities popping up when you try to describe these quantum things. And renormalization is basically a mathematically careful way to subtract infinite quantities to end up with something finite and meaningful. It's like balancing the books when you have infinite credits and debits.
Right, canceling out infinities.
But here's the kicker. Adding this specific infinite counter term, while necessary, it destroys convexity.
Destroys convexity. Why is convexity important? What does losing it do to the math?
Convexity is usually a mathematician's best friend for these kinds of problems. Imagine a smooth bowl shape that's convex. Easy to analyze, easy to find the minimum. Gradient estimates, which tell you how things change, often rely heavily on that kind of smooth, well-behaved landscape. When you destroy convexity, the landscape becomes, well, much wilder, full of unexpected cliffs and valleys, metaphorically speaking. It means the standard tools, the ones usually used to derive these crucial gradient estimates, they just don't work anymore, or at least not directly. It breaks a key assumption.
So the equation's incredibly rough. You've got literal infinities floating around, and the usual mathematical toolkit is broken because of this convexity issue. It sounds almost impossible. How did they manage to get any estimates out of this? This must be where that clever trick comes in, the stopping time thing.
Precisely. They use a technique called a stopping time argument. It's quite ingenious. And they were inspired by earlier work, particularly by Cass, Litterer, and Lyons. The core idea is, well, instead of trying to wrestle with this random quantity that keeps behaving badly, being non-integrable, meaning it can blow up, they do something different. They decide to just restart the noise whenever certain particularly troublesome parts of the equation called the Wick powers get too big.
Wick powers?
What are those, roughly?
Think of them as specific combinations of the rough terms in the equation that are especially prone to blowing up or causing mathematical headaches, very sensitive components. So the argument goes, whenever these sensitive Wick powers cross a certain predefined barrier, boom, hit the reset button on the noise driving the system.
Huh. So they just stop and start over when it gets too wild.
In a carefully controlled mathematical way, yes. It effectively bypasses the problem of exponential integrability. They avoid letting those problematic quantities grow without bound. It's like saying, okay, this is getting out of hand, let's just reset this part and continue.
That is a common ground. So they sidestep the worst of the problem. How does that help them actually calculate things?
It cleverly shifts the focus. Instead of analyzing the difficult original quantity directly, they end up studying a much simpler counting process. Let's call it N. This NT just counts how many times they have to hit that reset button up to time T.
Okay, just counting the reset.
Yeah. And because of a nice mathematical property called the strong Markov property, which means each time they reset,
the system truly starts fresh. No memory of the chaos before this counting process turns out to be quite well behaved. Specifically, it has exponential tails. Initial condition, you know, even theoretically infinite ones. And this makes the estimates apply over the entire time span, from time zero all the way to infinity. It gives the right. These gradient type estimates for what are called Markov semigroups, which describe the evolution of the system's probabilities, their vital tools. They're key to understanding related concepts called functional inequalities. Think of names like spectral gap inequalities or Poincaré inequalities and log-Sobolev inequalities. These inequalities are essentially mathematical ways to measure how quickly a system forgets its initial state and converges towards its stable long-term behavior, its equilibrium.
Measuring how fast things settle down.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that leads us right to the paper's main result, Theorem 1.1. They establish these gradient bounds for the Markov semigroup. And the punchline is, if the mass parameter M in the model is large enough, these bounds directly imply exponential contraction.
Exponential contraction. That sounds fast. So for the listener, what does that mean practically for a system like this? Does it just mean it forgets its starting point really, really quickly?
That's exactly it. Not just quickly, but exponentially quickly. The system races towards its equilibrium state, forgetting its initial conditions at an exponential rate. It's a very strong form of stability. And then, using a famous, powerful technique known as the classical approach of Bakri-Emery.
Bakri-Emery, okay.
Yes, it's a cornerstone method in this area. As a direct consequence of their gradient estimates, they prove something called a spectral gap inequality. That's Theorem 1.3. And this applies to the Varfi-42N measure itself, which is corollary 1.4. Again, provided the mass M is large enough, bigger than some critical value. And why care about a spectral gap? Well, it's a really convenient tool which quantifies ergodicity.
Ergodicity. Meaning
the system explores all its possible states properly over time and eventually settles into a unique equilibrium. The spectral gap gives you a hard number, a rate, for how fast that mixing and settling happens. It tells you precisely how quickly the system forgets its past. Think about stirring cream into coffee. The spectral gap would quantify how fast it becomes uniformly mixed.
That makes sense. So connecting this back, how does this improve on what was known before? You mentioned Tsatsouli's and Weber.
Right. So the fact that this system decays exponentially fast towards equilibrium wasn't entirely new. That was known from earlier work, like the paper by Tsatsouli's and Weber you mentioned. But this paper, it provides an estimate with respect to the L2X derivative, a specific way of measuring the change that is crucially uniform in the initial data. That uniformity is the big step forward here. It makes the result much more robust and generally applicable than previous estimates might have been.
I see. And they also compare their work to a very recent paper by Bauerschmidt and Dellier. What's the difference there? Sound like it involves different ways of measuring things, different norms.
Yes, the comparison is interesting and highlights some subtleties. This paper works on a mathematical space called a torus, which is like a donut shape.
Mm-hmm.
And the spectral gap inequality they derive involves something called the carré-Guichon, which is related to the energy, and it behaves like the HX1 norm, or almost like it. Now, this HX1 norm is particularly good at capturing the system's behavior at small scales, think high frequencies, or very fine details.
Like small scales.
Whereas the work by Bauerschmidt and Dagallier uses the more standard L2X norm. That norm is actually optimal for understanding large scales, low frequencies, the overall shape of things. So you have one result good for small details, another good for the big picture. And this naturally raises a question. Could there be a single unified spectral gap inequality that captures both the small scale and large scale behavior correctly? That's still an open point.
Interesting, like needing two different kinds of magnifying glasses right now. And you also mentioned that their estimate on the linearized equation 1.8 is considered important in its own right.
Absolutely. The linearized equation is a simplification of the full Messier equation. It's often easier to analyze, but still captures the central features. The estimate they derive for the simpler version is seen as a powerful analytical tool on its own. It's something other researchers might be able to pick up and use for related problems, maybe even outside of the specific VARPI 42 context, like a useful mathematical gadget.
A universal random.
Something like that. And these spectral gap inequalities more broadly, they pop up
in various fields. They're used in stochastic homogenization, for instance, understanding how random microscopic details average out to create smooth macroscopic properties in materials.
So wrapping this up, what does this all mean for you, the listener? It shows that even when dealing with incredibly abstract math tackling roughness, infinity, broken tools, the drive is often about understanding stability and predictability. And mathematicians invent these amazing tools, like the stopping time argument or using the Bakri-Emery method to get spectral gaps, which let us quantify how complex systems settle down. Whether it's quantum fields or maybe even models of materials, these techniques give us a rate, a measure of stability. What stands out to you about this approach? How pure mathematics finds ways to bring order and predictability to systems that seem, at first glance, like pure intractable chaos?